You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
In class, it's not so bad. But when school's out and the others go off to enjoy themselves, well, if you're what they call a shy guy, that's when you really feel it.
Welcome to episode 198 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by author Ian Fryer to discuss a 1967 film that is the 14th installment in a British film series that lasted for 31 movies. Starring Phil Silvers, Jim Dale, Peter Butterworth, Kenneth Williams, and Charles Hawtrey, directed by Gerald Thomas, it's Follow That Camel. But first...
You don't fool me for one moment, young lady.
What on earth has happened now?
Oh, it's Alex. I mean, Mr. Alexander Phipps. All he's interested in is...
The Forgotten Filmcast.
It's new!
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ice pole!
Lions may ice pole!
Tops up ice pole!
Squeeze up ice pole!
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ice pole!
Taste it!
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ice pole! Fresh, cool ice pole!
Orange flavor!
Strawberry flavor! Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ice pole!
Buy ice pole!
Happens!
Get an ice pole now!
Ting-a-ling-a-ling, ice pole!
It's no good you sitting there dying of thirst looking at these oranges. They're absolutely forbidden in here. I mean, it's not a greengrocer's, is it? I mean, they make a terrible mess. People get squirted in the eye and sometimes in the circle. I mean, all this peel, you know, the usherettes have absolutely refused to, and that came as a great surprise to the manager, because you see these pips, I mean, they get flicked at people in the front and they hit them in the back and they get trodden on. Messy business. On the other hand, we have no objection to you making loud slurping noises and dribbling down your front with your aura. Orange, your aura. Funnily enough, it's made from fresh oranges. Oh, excuse me. Went up my nose.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
Now, this isn't going to hurt.
And so, a great hospital swings into action.
Darling, are you all right?
It's doctors, nurses, and orderlies working calmly, coolly and efficiently to relieve the suffering of others.
Oh! What a carry-on!
Oh,
As that well-known prescription for laughter, the Carry On team present a bed panorama of hospital life. Carry On Doctor.
Bunnies in a hurry?
Peter Rogers and Gerald Thomas invite you to take the cure for all depression in this hilarious hospital.
Smile, please.
Smile? What with?
Frankie Howard.
Oh. Come now, Mr. Bigger. We don't want to lie in our nice, comfortable bed with our nasty old pants on, do we now?
Madam, what you do in your bed is your own affair.
Sydney James.
Where's my watch?
You must have taken it off.
No, no, I distinctly remember having it on when I started to sew that... Hello. Oh, no. It was an alarm, too.
Kenneth Williams, the hospital's prize surgeon.
Is this your first?
First? First what?
Baby.
Huh?
Charles Hawtrey is having a baby? Jim Dale, the handsome, hopeless hospital Romeo.
Looking pair.
You took the words right out of my mouth.
Barbara Windsor. Hattie Jakes and a more matronly matron you couldn't wish to meet. Joan Sims.
Mr. Bigger's very fond of fresh flowers, especially chrysanthemums. He's never without a pot by his bed.
Bernard Breslau.
What's your trouble?
Oh, I had my appendix out.
Appendix? All about your leg.
Oh, no. That happened when I fell off the operating table.
Anita Harris.
Morning, Mr. Ooh. Ooh.
Peter Butterworth.
And now, on with the show.
Jezebel!
I'll never trust another woman as long as I live.
Disgusting. If you did that in England, you'd get fined £5. Where are we, Sergeant? Do you know?
Yes, it's the Oasis El Nuki. It's the only waterhole within 200 miles. You have done well. You will be rewarded.
I want no other reward than to be favored with the loving attentions of my lord.
It shall be done. Wait in my tent. I hope you had a pleasant journey, gentlemen.
No. We have been treated outrageously, and I demand to see the British consul. What's the matter? Did I say something funny?
I don't know, but keep going. He might rupture something.
Quiet! You miserable camel droppings! I beg your pardon! You can't talk to a British subject like that!
Hey, take it easy, Bo. Take it easy!
No, I won't! I will not be humiliated in this manner! If you're going to kill us, why don't you shoot us now and get it over with?
That is an excellent idea. You and your big mouth. But first, I require some information. Of course, anything you want to know, just fire away. How many accursed legionnaires are there at the outpost in Fort Soissonneuf? Let me see. How many legionnaires are at Fort Soissonneuf?
You're not going to tell him, are you?
Well, no, it's a perfectly harmless question.
Well, of course it isn't. He obviously wants to find out so that he can attack it.
Oh, come off it, Bo. Not him, not this kindly old gentleman.
It is true. The infidels will all perish when the second crescent of the moon enters the third phase of Orion.
When is that?
Tuesday. First the accursed legionnaires at Fort Soissonneuf, and then the infidels at Sidi Bel Abbes. It has been ordained by the prophet Mustafa Leek.
Mustafa Leek!
Mustafa Leek. Now, you will tell me how many men.
You know, for the moment, it seems to have slipped my mind. If I could just pop back to the barracks for a moment and have a word with our commandant.
Don't trifle with me, accursed one! Perhaps a little torture will help you to remember. You have until nightfall to come to your senses. If not, they will come off one by one.
One by one. I suppose he means our ears.
That's my boy. Always thinking of the higher things. Look, Chiefy, if he could just have a word and talk this over sensibly with this, Mustafa Leek.
Mustafa Leek!
I don't know. Must be number one on the hit parade.
Okay, our movie this time is Follow That Camel from 1967. And joining me to discuss this film is author Ian Fryer. Ian, welcome to the show.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for having me on.
It's great to have you on the show. Before we get too far into everything, let me have you take a moment here, tell everybody a bit about yourself and what you do.
Okay, well, my name is Ian Fryer, and I write about old movies and TV series. For many years, I've been the editor of the Gerry Anderson fan club magazine, who you may be familiar with from shows like Fireball XL5 and Space 1999 and lots of others. From there, I was headhunted by a publisher and said, "Would you happen to know anybody who would want to write a book about Gerry and Sylvia Anderson's work?" To which I obviously said, me, I'll do it. And they clearly liked what I did because I've contracted for several more. So I then wrote a book about the history of British horror films, a book I was born to write. I so enjoyed writing that one. And then it wasn't something I particularly studied before, but they asked me to write a book about the Carry On films. The thing is, they are quite central to British comedy culture. So I wasn't having to think, what are the Carry On films? I don't know anything about them. Everybody below, say, the age of, above rather, the age of, say, 35 in Britain knows what the Carry On films are and has a working knowledge of them. And there are quite a lot of books out here in England on the subject already. So I did have to think, how can I make this unique? So if you read my book, which is called Carrying On, you will learn about the wider film career of the producer and director team who made them, Peter Rogers and Gerald Thomas. And you will learn a lot about the history of post-war British comedy. It's all just one big story. Everybody's linked into everybody else. And it's one of the most fascinating pieces of research that I've ever done. I've come out of here a much bigger Carry On fan, which I regard as a kind of comedy version of Stockholm Syndrome almost. But to give you an idea of how central... Oh, thank you. I've been dying to use that, Jack. But to give you an idea about how central Carry Ons are to the British culture, Follow That Camel is on national TV next Saturday as we record this.
Oh, excellent.
and it's not unusual. It's on all the time. You know, these Carry-Ons are shown all the time. You know, they've stayed a part of the national comedy conversation in ways in which other very popular comedies of the era simply haven't. I mean, Todd, are you familiar with Norman Wisdom?
I can't say that I am.
Ah, there we are. Now, Norman Wisdom was a huge comedy star in Britain. He almost broke the American market. He did a really good film called The Night They Raided Minsky's. In, I think, 67?
Yes, I've heard of that. I've never seen that one, but I've heard of it.
He got really good notices for it, but then he had to come back. His marriage was breaking up, and the moment passed. But Norman Wisdom was sort of a British chaplain. I know Chaplin was British, but a British-based chaplain working in the 50s and 60s. And his films were absolute blockbusters. They virtually kept ranked films going single-handedly, but now they are nothing like so prominent as the Carry Ons. And the Carry Ons were kind of the little underdog made for very little money that were, to some extent critically sneered at. But if I talk to younger people about the Carry Ons, even if they're not that familiar with them, they'll say, "Oh, yes, I like the crinkly faced man. That's Sid James," who was the everyone can do the Sid James laugh as well, which is sort of the British people in Muttley, I suppose. And he goes, "Ah, ah, 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 ah." Everybody can do that instantly. But Sid wasn't available for this one, which is what makes it interesting. Every now and again, the Carry-Ons would try to break the American market. Sometimes it worked. The second film in the series, which was Carry On Nurse in 1959, was a genuinely really big American hit. every now and again, they would try to recreate that. This was one of those moments.
We'll get more into that here in a moment here, because, yes, this has a big American star in it, which I found very interesting. Before we dig too much into Follow That Camel and just the Carry On films in general, which, by the way, I've only seen two of them, so I'm a complete novice in this regard. But I wanted to just ask you real quick about one of the other things you hit on there, because I find this to be an intriguing subject as well. I think you and I are wired a lot the same way from the little interactions that we've had so far. But Gerry Anderson, Super Marionation, we got to talk about this for a moment. I have always found this to be intriguing, the shows that he created to be very intriguing. Part of that is because I am a puppeteer myself. I worked as a puppeteer for many years, not with marionettes, but with more like the Muppet style puppets. And it was always a great thrill for me when people would ask me what I did for a living. And I was able to say, I'm a professional puppeteer. And they'd be like, what? So any kind of show that involves puppets, I find endlessly intriguing. And of course, the shows that Gerry Anderson created are so unique. So I guess, you know, talk to me a little bit about your interest in this artist.
Oh, well, again, if you're of a certain age, Gerry Anderson was everywhere. I mean, do you know what? Once you can get into X films and pubs, you don't care what age you are, I always find. But if I just do a little bit of addition, 58, I'm 58, or possibly 59, I've lost track. And if you're my age, when you are in your sort of pre-teens, Gerry Anderson is everywhere. He didn't even want to be a puppeteer. He set up a TV production company at the time in which commercial TV, in other words, not the BBC, was first being introduced into Britain. And he thought people would be to pass through his door and say, we want a remake of Ben-Hur. Can you deliver it by Tuesday? Nothing. Eventually, he was asked to make a cornflakes advert. I think it was possibly Rice Krispies, a Kellogg's advert using the character Noddy, who is a children's character from the author Enid Blyton. And he did it. And as a sort of result of that, another producer came and said, a lady called Roberta Lee, a remarkable lady called Roberta Lee, came and said, we need to do this series based on my character, Twizzle, who was like a children's book character in quite a similar vein. And he did it. And the way Gerry was wired was that, look, I don't want to make puppet series, but if I will make the best puppet series it's humanly possible to make. Then somebody sometime will actually offer me some live action work and do the stuff I want to do. And it's interesting to compare his early work to the other puppet series that were around, because immediately you can see how much better they are. He's using the grammar of film. He's not just pointing a camera at puppets. You know, there are close-ups, there are tracking shots, there are dolly ins. There is good lighting, and the puppet thing just grew and grew, and he broke the American market. Lou Grade, the great Sir Lou Grade, Lord Grade,
the same genius who brought the Muppet Show to television screens as well.
Well, this wasn't his first time at the rodeo with regards to puppets, because he bought Gerry's company. And he saw the potential there, and he sold series like Supercar, which sold very well in America, and the follow-up, Fireball XL5, which was the first British series ever to air coast-to-coast on an American network. And the science fiction part of it just took off and took off. The big hit over here was a show called Thunderbirds. Now, how familiar is that series to American audiences, do you think?
I think if you're of the right age, it certainly is. I certainly saw it in reruns when I was growing up in the 70s. So I think if you're around the age that I am, that you're probably pretty familiar with Thunderbirds.
Okay, because it didn't show on the networks. They blew Grade for once, blew the deal, and the networks backed out. But that's the series he's most remembered, Gerry Anderson most remembered for. In Britain, it was a massive hit at the time, and then it had a huge resurge in interest when the BBC bought it for screenings in the 1990s, and it became a huge phenomenal success all over again. The shops were full of Thunderbirds toys. And then eventually he moved on to live action with shows like UFO, which has the best theme tune in the world, and Space 1999. And then there was quite the lull in his career. I mean, Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, who were kind of the partnership who made them, they broke up, and Jerry really struggled for a few years. But at this point, the sort of fan interest in the series, people like me, all reached a certain age where we actually wanted to discuss them. And so I started getting involved with, you know, conventions and writing about the series. And eventually, people who actually had the money to make TV series reached a certain age where, oh, Jerry's still about. We'd love to make a series with him. And he made quite a successful comeback. I mean, there is a show called Terror Hulk from the early 80s, and he's using more sort of more of the puppets that you would have used, latex hand puppets.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese took an interest because a lot of Japanese shows are quite interestingly similar to the stuff Jerry was making.
Oh,
they always had a very
absolutely
market. Yeah.
Well, especially when you consider all the model work and such. I mean, when you see that, it makes you think of what you see in like kaiju movies and shows out of Japan.
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of Japanese anime and model shows specifically reference the Anderson shows because they were so popular over there. So, I mean, Jerry worked until the end. I mean, he worked for absolutely as long as he could. He described himself as a film technician down to his bones. But, you know, this sort of infrastructure has grown up around him of people like me who just loved his shows and loved to write about them. And to this day, I mean, I've just delivered another batch of articles for Fanderson, the official Jerry Anderson Appreciation Society, which I'm still involved with. You never run out of things to write about the shows.
Oh, yeah, no.
The shows themselves are just so endlessly fascinating and cover such a wide area of British television and show business history. I mean, I'd like to say as a writer, I kind of taught myself to write by writing about Jerry shows.
Oh, that's great. I mean, when you were describing that word fascinating, that's exactly the word popped into my mind. I think that's why they're so intriguing. There's just so much interesting stuff going on there. So much great artistry when it comes to not just the puppets, but the models and all that. I've always been fascinated by those shows. So it's great to hear you talk about them with such enthusiasm. Let's move on now to our feature film that we have here. Follow That Camel from 1967. And as you probably guessed, as we've been talking, this is a part of the Carry On series, though my understanding is this is one of only two of the series that did not, at least in its initial British release, have the words Carry On in its title. I think in years since, as it's been released on video in various parts of the world, they have added the words Carry On to the title. But my understanding is officially it's just known as Follow That Camel.
Shall I tell you the background as to why that happened?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. The first, I think it was 12 Carry On films were all made by kind of a B-movie company called Anglo Amalgamated. And one of the partners in Anglo Amalgamated died. And the remaining partner, a chap called Jack Cohen, said he didn't want to make the Carry Ons anymore. He actually rejected the series, although each one was more and more successful. They just did a wonderful Hammer horror spoof called Carry On Screaming, which I would recommend to Hammer fans. It's wonderful. But he wanted to take the company up market, and he just dropped the series. Fortunately, Rank Films, who had been making great amounts of money with the Norman Wisdom comedies, needed a replacement because Wisdom was getting on a bit and that series had run its course. So they immediately bought the series, but they were very nervous about using the Carry On name because, well, two reasons. One, it was associated with the product of another company. And so I was like, oh, well, we don't want them making money because, you know, they'll re-release their films if we make having that. But the other thing is there was the idea abroad that the Carry On name might belong to Anglo Amalgamated. They might not legally be allowed to use it. They said that not to be the case. So after they did two films, they did Don't Lose Your Head, which is a spoof on the Scarlet Pimpernel, and they did Follow That Camel, and after that, they made Carry On Doctor, and they said, yeah, we're happy, Carry On, a as it were.
Yes, they decided to carry on. Absolutely. Now, before we dig into this one specifically, and I know you gave a little bit of info already, but tell us a little bit just about the folks that are kind of responsible for this series. Because like I said, this is a British institution. And, you know, I think that most of us here in the States are probably not as familiar. I remember seeing a few of the titles sitting on the video store shelves back in the 80s when I was a teenager. I can remember seeing a few of the titles, like as I was reading through the back of TV Guide every week to see what movies were on TV, I would see Carry On This or Carry On That pop up every now and then, and I had no idea what that was. But, I mean, you said earlier that pretty much if you're over 35 on your side of the pond, you know these films. I don't think that's the case here in the States. So for us stupid Americans, give us the basics on Carry On.
Oh, I'm not going American bashing. There is too much of that. Americans, no. The series started in 1958. We're going back to commercial television again. Everything leads back to commercial television because the BBC had a monopoly on television for many years. And then suddenly the law changed and a commercial television station, a national commercial television station called ITV, which was a series of franchises, depending on where you lived in the country, was set up. Now, the first sitcom hit that ITV had was a film called The Army Game, which was, we had national service here. People had to do 18 months or so in the military when they reached a certain age. So it was, the military was very much in that era, a shared experience. Which is why you get so much. I mean, we'll be talking about Bilko. It's the same thing in that era of the post-war.
Sure.
Military is a shared experience. So lots of comedies based around that. Now, this was, as I say, it was a really big hit, was The Army Game. But for reasons unknown, they had a class clear out. And suddenly, cast members such as William Hartnell, the first Doctor Who, and Charles Hawtrey, were suddenly free, as in unemployed. Now, they were snapped up by the Carry On producer, Peter Rogers, who made a kind of unofficial Army Game film. This was Carry On Sergeants, which was a massive hit. And interestingly, a much bigger hit than the actual Army Game film, which came the following year. But then he thought, right, I'm going to run with this idea. And so then they made Carry On Nurse, which was very successful in America. And then the series was up and running. And they had a very good writer called Norman Hudis. Now, Hudis wrote about the first half dozen. And then he went off to America, where he had a very good career. He wrote episodes of Mission Impossible and Man from U.N.C.L.E. So this was a Renaissance man. He could write anything. But he had a really interesting formula for the Carry On films, which was people from all different backgrounds all being put together in the new structures of post-war Britain. So Carry On Sergeant, you've got National Service. Carry On Nurse, you've got the National Health Service, our sort of national hospital system, which was very new then. It was only been running about 10 years. Carry On Teacher, you've got comprehensive education. You can only do this so often, but that was his basic idea. And his Carry On films all fit into that pattern. So he went off to America and they got lucky. Okay. And they got an absolute comedy genius called Talbot Rothwell. Now, Talbot Rothwell was a very different type of writer. He was a gag machine and he completely changed the focus of the films. And we're talking about from about 1963-64 onwards here. One of the things he introduces is historical carry-ons, by which we're really meaning movie parodies. So they did Carry On Jack. Now, Carry On Jack is around the time of the Spanish Armada. It's a seafaring adventure. And they hit upon the idea of they had all the sets available to them from a film made the previous year with Alec Guinness and Dirk Bogarde, on HMS Defiance, and all these wonderful sets. So on the same money that they could make, say, Carry On Constable a couple of years earlier, which is funny but frankly cheap-looking, they were able to make an Eastman colour extravaganza with the most wonderful sets for basically the same cost. And so they carried on. So they made, after that, they carried on Spying, which is a spy spoof in the very early days of James Bond. They made Carry On Cleo. Did you see Carry On Cleo?
I have not, though. I'm familiar with that. That's one of the titles I see mentioned the most, I think.
Now, Carry On Cleo, when the Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor Cleopatra was being made, the original idea was they were going to make it at Pinewood Studios. But Liz Taylor got ill when she always suffered from very poor health. And it was so delayed that they were trying to recreate ancient Egypt in Britain in November. See the problem, you're in North Africa and you can see everybody's breath because it's so cold. So wiser heads prevailed, and they went off to Cinecittà in Italy and thought, yeah, we'll go bankrupt 20th Century Fox in Italy instead. The weather's nicer. But all the sets were still lying about in Pinewood in England. They had all they just left all the sets behind. So Carry On Cleo, again, the same principle. They were able to make this wonderful comedy, which looks fantastic, for Daryl's Annex cigar bill. Carry On Cowboy comes after that. That's a very detailed spoof of High Noon. Talbot Ruffel was wonderful at writing these spoofs, and his other skill was making really quite complicated plots, because we've got such a large ensemble cast by then that all of whom need to be given something to do.
Sure.
And he was an absolute master at that. And he carried on till 1974 writing these films. And he had a breakdown partway through writing Carry On Dick. You can see the direction of travel of the films by this title. But that's based on the legend of Dick Turpin. And he had a mental breakdown halfway through writing it, simply through overwork. I mean, he was writing that. He was writing stage shows. He was writing sitcoms. The poor man simply worked himself to death. But yeah, that's where we're at this point in the Carry On films, when we got Follow That Camel. Two things are happening: we're doing movie spoofs and we're doing large ensemble casts, all of whom had an established comedic persona, which Talbot Rothwell was able to, as it were, service.
Let's move on here with the film itself then. Follow That Camel from 1967. Correct me if I'm wrong, I think I saw that it is the 14th in the series, which totaled 31 films, if I read all that correctly. And I was very surprised to find they're all directed by the same person, Gerald Thomas.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't think I can think of another film series, certainly not one that lasted 31 films, but I mean, even a film series that lasted 5, 6, 7 films, where the same director is helming every time. I was blown away by that. I mean, he's got some other credits in his filmography, but most of his credits are the Carry On series.
Filmography are with the same producer.
Yeah, yeah.
With exception. So, yeah, I mean, so Peter Rogers and Gerald Thomas were just this absolute factory producing films. And I would say that they would have a really valuable place in British film history, even if they hadn't made the Carry On films. They would still have a really interesting back catalogue. But, yeah, the Carry-Ons is definitely what they'll be remembered for.
Now, this one, it falls into that category, like you were saying, of kind of parodying a film genre or, popular stories or that people were familiar with. This one, I think you can see a lot of ties to the 1924 adventure novel Beau Geste, which, of course, has been turned into film a couple times. Our lead character here is named Beau West, and he's played by Jim Dale. And at the beginning of the film, there is an incident involving a cricket match where his honor comes into question and he ends up losing the hand of his love, the Lady Jane, played by Angela Douglas. And unable to clear his name, Beau and his manservant Simpson, who's played by Peter Butterworth, they head out to the Middle East to join the French Foreign Legion. Once they arrive there, they meet Sergeant Knocker, played by Phil Silvers, not a regular part of the Carry On team. I'm sure we'll talk about that here more in a minute. He's a bit of a con man who often goes off for rendezvous with local ladies under the guise of going out on, quote, patrol. Of course, all of this is unknown to the commandant, Commandant Berger, played by Kenneth Williams, and his assistant, Captain Lapice, played by Charles Hawtrey. Now, back in England, Lady Jane learns that Beau really didn't do anything wrong after all at the beginning of the movie, so she heads out to find him and bring him back. And after some misadventures, she ends up being kidnapped by a local sheik, played by Bernard Breslau, and he wants to make her his 13th wife. So now it's up to Bo and Sergeant Knocker to lead the French Foreign Legion in an attack on the enemy fortress and to rescue the girl in the process. You know, it's falling into a lot of those categories that that Ian was talking about a moment ago, you know, as far as where the Carry On series went. But one of the things that's the most intriguing here, I'm sure we'll get into in a moment, is the fact that it brought in a American television star, and he gets top billing here. But I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. I'm going to let Ian get things going on this one. So what are your thoughts on Follow That Camel specifically?
Oh, let's run with Phil Silvers. The acknowledged head of the Carry On cast was Sid James, who we've already mentioned. The thing is, Sid was an extremely popular actor, and he had a hit sitcom called George and the Dragon, and he had theatre tours, and there just came a time when he wasn't available for the shooting dates. So they had to hire somebody of a sufficient stature to head the cast. Now, the other thing to remember here is Bilko was huge in Britain. Bilko was on air from pretty much when it came out in the mid-50s up until 2004.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Bilko was repeated by the BBC for almost that entire time.
I find that amazing because the Phil Silvers Show, as it was originally known, or Sergeant Bilko, I was familiar with it. But it is not a show that, at least where I grew up in the Chicago area, that was regularly played on UHF television and reruns. I mean, you know, I grew up watching Andy Griffith and the Beverly Hillbillies and I Dream of Jeannie and all those shows from that era. They were running on daytime reruns, but I do not ever remember Bilko being a part of that. So it's not a show that I have as much memory of it. It sounds like it endured a lot longer on your side of the pond.
You bet. There is one Phil Silvers museum in the world. It's in Coventry in England. Britain loved Bilko. Britain loved... and we got the sequel series as well. There was another series called The New Phil Silvers Show, which was only ran a season. It was a big flop, but, you know, we got that as well. So, yeah, that's pretty much why he was hired. I think the idea with the producer Peter Rogers and the director Gerald Thomas was that he's a big name. He might help us break the American market. But I think he was doing that well in the States at the time. In fact, when he came over, marriage had just broken up. He'd gambled away every cent he'd ever earned. I've heard him described as a degenerate gambler. He was an absolute gambling addict. He was in a very poor state of mental health. And I've read Kenneth Williams' diaries, which have been published. I mean, Williams was kind of a spiky character, and he said that, you know, he just bawled the pants off everybody talking about his troubles and talking about name dropping. And then he'd get on set and he couldn't remember a single line. All his lines were on what we call dummy boards, but, you know, he had all his lines behind the actors. And you watch the film and he's giving a fantastic high intensity performance. You have no idea any of going on. Silvers is wonderful in this film.
Yeah, it was interesting for me just the contrast between him and the rest of the cast, which, you know, as you kind of mentioned before, I gather these are folks that have worked together a lot on other films. They've all got their set kind of on-screen personas and such. And then you throw into the mix this American television star. And I got to imagine that was a challenge for everybody. But I think that the two things end up meshing together pretty well. I mean, Silvers is doing his thing. He's essentially doing Bilko here. I mean, this character is Bilko, basically. But there's something that really worked for me with just this brash, cocky, con man American character. And then you have these stiff upper lip British characters in there as well. I thought that really worked for some nice comedy.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's a school of comedy, which is really popular in Britain. I mean, you know, we've got Bilko. I mean, the cast would have been familiar with it, with Phil Silvers' act just through Bilko, because everybody watched it. But you know, the Marx Brothers were popular over here. Olsen and Johnson, Helter Poppin, things like that. You know, it was a very popular style of comedy, which I think would have met the British audiences and the cast would have been in sync with. And of course, Phil Silvers, of course, was not just a movie actor. He was a stage veteran. And, you know, he was a professional, even though he was having problems. He could fit in with an ensemble cast because it's just, you know, where he came from.
Well, one of the things, too, that I thought was great, and you kind of mentioned there, you mentioned folks like the Marx Brothers and those types of acts. And as I was watching it, I definitely got that kind of vibe. My brain actually went more to like an Abbott and Costello type of vibe, you know, especially in some of the scenes where you have Phil Silvers interacting with Jim Dale. There's that scene where they first go to the Sheik's camp. And you know, they're prisoners and such. And there's this wonderful wordplay and back and forth between these two that I thought, this feels like Bud and Lou almost.
Yeah. I'm sure that would have been in Talbot Rothwell's mind as well, because we loved Abbott and Costello over here. They were hugely successful. We haven't mentioned Jim Dale, and Jim Dale is such a gifted physical comedian. The survival rate of the cast on this film is actually really good. Quite a few of the cast members are still with us. Angela Douglas is still with us. Jim Dale is still with us. I'm trying to think, there was one other whose name escapes me. But Jim Dale was the big discovery of the Carry Ons. He was a comedian and he was a pop singer, but he was developed slowly into a leading man in the Carry On films. And by this point in the Carry On films, he's matured into a wonderful physical comedian. I mean, all the bits of it where he's trying to get off the camel and he falls backwards and forwards off it, depending on what he's doing. You know, that's just him. And, you know, and one of the very few scenes in which he got a second take. Because, look, he said to the director, who was very much a one-take guy, I can do better. And, you know, he was gifted enough to do that. I mean, he was an absolutely fearless physical comedian who injured himself quite a few times making the films. I mean, if you ever see Carry On Doctor, some of the stunts you do in that are terrifying. But and Dale eventually, they did a Tarzan spoof a few years later, which he's called Carry On Up the Jungle. And he had the choice of playing the Tarzan character in a wordless role, or he had an offer to play at the National Theatre from Lord Olivier. What do you think? Yeah, he went on stage. So, yeah, he kind of came too big for the Carry Ons eventually. You really have to mention it because he's so good in this.
He's wonderfully awkward, I think, is the way I was looking at his performance, because he's got that kind of vibe to him where he just doesn't feel totally comfortable in every situation he's dealing with. Some of the scenes that are the best with him is where he's fumbling over himself as he deals with women.
Yes, and he's very thin, and he's all arms and legs. He's kind of got a comedy physicality about him. I'm kind of doing my arms and legs as well. This is a podcast. You can't see my arms, but he's just there's almost a Buster Keaton quality about him, and in fact he did Barnum on stage. He was that good. He could do that every night on stage because he created the part of Barnum on the New York stage on Broadway.
Well, talk to me a little bit about, you know, as we look at some of the other cast members here, you'd mentioned how a lot of these folks have kind of these comedic personas that they often played. And I definitely got that impression as I was going through things here. I think the one that jumped out to me the most, based again on my limited knowledge of the Carry On films, I've only seen one other one, and that was Carry On Camping. But the one character in this that jumped out to me going, okay, well, he's basically playing the same type of character he was before, is Charles Hawtrey.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned Charles Hawtrey. Charles Hawtrey, what a strange man Charles Hawtrey was. He had that sort of unique style where he would talk and he would look at the camera rather than the other actors. And he forced you to look at him. He sort of had this very odd thing which didn't work outside of the Carry On films. If you ever see him in dramatic roles, you think, this guy can't act at all. What's he doing? It's perfect. But he had this very strange thing of either while he's delivering the line or straight after, he would look at the camera. And so all the audience could do would be to look at him. Mm-hmm. What a piece of scene stealing. A very odd man. I mean, he was a gay man at a point where it was illegal. And just absolutely made no bones about it. And, you know, how he was on the screen was at least 50% of how he was off the screen. But he had such a long struggle to make it that it sort of had affected him in some quite negative ways. his mother died and he never recovered. He became a terrible alcoholic. And at this point, he was drinking on set. And so they wouldn't entrust him with any role bigger than the role he had here. And his roles would tend to be quite often limited and away from the rest of the cast, just in case he let them down. They were sort of starting to have a Charles Autry exit strategy at this point, just in case. And there came the day, unfortunately, where it was right, where, I mean, they were making a Christmas special. I mean, that's the thing with the Carry-Ons. It's a movie phenomenon, but they made TV series. They made stage series. For a while, there was an annual Christmas Carry-On TV special, and they had a big role organized for him for that, but he came back and says, I want top billing. And the staff, or I'm not going on. And they said, you can't be serious. And he was absolutely serious. And he just walked away from it, let them down at the last minute, and they had to recast. And they never used him again after that. But I think that was him walking away from the series, really. But that was a kind of a motif throughout his career. He was a sideman to a wonderful British comedian in the 1930s and 40s called Will Hay. And I would recommend you search out some Will Hay films. They're absolutely fantastic. You can catch them all online. And Will Hay's basic shtick was he was a slightly seedy schoolmaster, complete with the cape and the sort of mortarboard hat. And Hawtrey, who was by this point well into his 30s, was a cheeky schoolboy. And eventually, Hawtrey got too big for his boots, asked for more money and more billing. Suddenly, Hawtrey was unemployed again. And several times throughout his career. But let's say Hawtrey, he had this comedic personality. It worked in the context of the Carry-On films. And so they were happy to put up with the downside of working with him at certain points. He's really good. Hawtrey is making me laugh. Sorry.
Well, and I thought he was great at playing off of the commandant character, Kenneth Williams, because the two of them basically, you'll pretty much share every scene that they're in. I don't know. There's just a great dynamic there. And it was one of the strangest aspects of the film, I thought. Just for one thing, Kenneth Williams, all right, help me out here. This is the French Foreign Legion. He feels like he's a German colonel. I mean, he's like, he's Colonel Klink from Hogan's Heroes almost here. And I was like, this is really odd. I couldn't quite figure out where that choice was coming from, yet I was enjoying it quite a bit. But I also have to kind of put myself in the context of, all right, this is 67. You know, we're barely 20 years removed from the war itself. So I found it a really odd choice that this character was, they don't come out and say it, but basically seems like he's a Nazi in the middle of the French Foreign Legion.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with the French Foreign Legion, the whole point of it is, in the movie terms, is that you can, it's where you go if you want to forget about your past. If you want to run away from it, then you do a stint in the French Foreign Legion, which is why Beau West is there. So, no, I don't think that's a problem. And Williams was an accents guy. He was a big radio star because he was fantastic at different accents. And so they would give him different things to do. I mean, he had a very broad American accent in Carry On Cowboy, based on Hal Roach. He met Hal Roach and based his performance on him. Oh. So every time. So, yeah, so he would kind of have a different accent almost in every film. By the time you get to the end of the series, they do Carry On Emmanuel, which is nothing like as rude as the title would appear, which is one reason why no. And he does the entire thing in a French accent. I actually prefer German accents. But yeah, Williams, again, was an absolute national figure in Britain. He was, you know, he was a huge star, but possibly a little bit typecast by the Carry-Ons. He never really got a little work again after the series ended, and he stayed with the series virtually until the end. Williams is the actor who is in the most films.
Looking at the rest of this cast, I mean, I know a lot of these are folks that appeared in several of these movies. We've talked about several of them here already that kind of have some of the bigger roles. But I guess who else stands out for you in the cast? Because I mean, that is one of the keys of this series, right? That they have these large casts of a bunch of interesting characters. I've always enjoyed films like that. I mean, that's why I'm unapologetic about how I loved like the Police Academy movies and things like that, because I love movies where there's an odd assortment of characters brought together. So who are some of the other folks that kind of stand out for you in this one?
Okay, Berta Breslau. Berta Breslau plays...
I agree.
And the thing is with Berta Breslau, Berta Breslau was the breakout star of the sitcom we were talking about earlier of The Army Game. But he had the... I mean, he was 6'7" tall. At that point, beanpole...
Huge guy.
He had this comedic persona which carried over from then and kind of was typecast with as being the big dumb lug. And he talked like this. This is my Berta Breslau impression, this is. He was absolutely typecast doing those roles. Actually, he was an extremely intelligent guy, a massive book collector, played Shakespeare, but he was stuck doing this. What they hit upon with the historical carry-ons is that he could do a brilliant villain. I mean, there are issues now about blackface because he's playing an Arab character with boot polish all over his face. But putting it in the context of 1967, that performance could have passed muster in a straight movie. He's such a big, powerful actor that, bear in mind, there was a remake of BoJess only the previous year in 66 with Telly Savalas, which I think is probably why they made this, because it was going to be a big super production, and actually they just made it for threepence in the Hollywood Hills, and it was rubbish. But in that way that Universal B-movies of the 60s sometimes are, it was rubbish. But, you know, they were still all fired up to make this one, thankfully. But, you know, these films were still being made seriously in the era in which this film came out. So, and he does the same thing in a few films. Let me get my list here. I do beg your pardon. This is podcast gold. listen to the participants quickly Google something. It's always the highlight of any podcast. Like Carry On Screaming, he plays the butler, and in a really interesting piece of, you know, the same product being developed simultaneously in two places, what he came up with was exactly the same as Ted Cassidy as Lurch, but never had seen what the other was doing at that point. I checked the dates, and, you know, there's plausible deniability there, at least. And Carry On Up the Jungle, again, he's in blackface. He took the trouble to learn the correct African dialect and started talking to it with all the other extras, who it turned out were all from London. I have no idea what he was doing.
I agree that he's great in this film. I thought he was one of the highlights for sure. And as I was watching it, I thought, first of all, I thought he's channeling Anthony Quinn. He felt like Anthony Quinn to me. And I was like, this is a great comedic villain performance. I could just as well, though, see this guy doing a straight villain performance. He's that much of a screen presence. So I really appreciated what he was doing here.
Joe Sims plays Zigzig, the sort of slightly blousy. I guess she's probably the local madam. Mm-hmm. House of ill repute. But she was a wonderful actress, and at one point was quite the glamour star of the Carry On films. But she put a little weight on, she sort of aged a little quickly, but she was a wonderful comedian and actually madly attractive in a certain way. So, yeah, she was just fantastic in this. Anita Harris as Corktip, the dancer. Anita Harris is one of the surviving cast members from this film. She's still around now. She still looks incredible. And she turns up in two. She's in Carry On Again, Nurse as well. Only made the two in the series, but she was kind of a popular singer in England. And, you know, she doesn't have a huge acting career, but she really gives a good account of herself in this. And boy, can she belly dance.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, and I'm glad you brought up some of the ladies in this, because I did want to ask kind of about just the role that women play in this series, because I mean, one of the things that certainly struck me watching this is that while I'm certainly getting vibes of classic kind of comedy, you know, we talked about things like Abbott and Costello and the Marx Brothers and things like that. And yet at the same time, I think there is that kind of that difference between what we were able to do on screen in America and what you were able to get away with in Britain, because there's certainly a bit more in the way of innuendo and just more, shall we say, bawdy approach to things that I don't think we could say we had in American films of this era.
Yeah, although looking back at them and having watched them quite intently over the last few years, they're full of strong female roles as well. They kind of have their cake and eat it. I mean, that side of the films where, you know, more and more skin is revealed as the 60s wear on, and especially into the 70s, becomes more and more of a feature of the films. And it's kind of used as a stick to beat the Carry On films with, because that part of the Carry On legacy has become a bit dated. I mean, as I mentioned, virtually the last of the series was one called Carry On Emmanuel, where they were spoofing the soft porn Emmanuel films of the 70s. Not very well either, unfortunately. Although I'm a bigger fan of that film than a lot of people. There's one central sequence, which is quite wonderful, but we may do that. We probably won't do that in another podcast. It's quite an unloved film, is that one, for good reason. But yeah, so yeah, despite the fact that the films sort of sell sex more and more as they go along, they always have very strong female roles in them. And so, you know, accusations of sexism only go so far. I mean, they made the start of Barbara Windsor, who is this tiny British actress who was the nearest equivalent we had to a kind of, I don't want to say Marilyn Monroe, Laura Mamie Van Doren, the wonderful Mamie, who is again happily still with us.
Still with us, yep.
Yeah. We follow each other on Twitter. She's wonderful. you know, she was less than 5 feet tall, and she always said she played the part of a busty woman because she just had this way of walking where she would just throw her shoulders back, everything else rocketed forward, and, you know, this is somebody who could put on the Barbara Windsor persona, which was this busty, giggly, it was a very natural persona. And again, Barbara Windsor was an absolute national heroine, I suppose you would say. To the end of her days, she got a big role in Britain's most popular soap opera called EastEnders. And she did a completely serious role in that towards the end of the last 20 years of her life. But yeah, Barbara Windsor isn't in this, but she is a figure that anyone following the Carry On films certainly would know about. In this film, it's almost more about as much about the Carry On cast members who aren't in it, like Sid and Barbara, than the ones who are. Angela Douglas is more plays that sort of role, but I can't really imagine Barbara Windsor as Lady Jane, because she's more Cockney. But Douglas is excellent in this. She's very, very good in screaming. So yeah, if anyone wants to investigate Carry On Screaming, her and Jim Dale are wonderful together. They're a really good comedic partnership. But Angela Douglas, who was Kenneth Moore's wife, which was quite the scandal at the time, because he left his wife and went off with Angela Douglas, who was much younger than him. But, you know, they stayed married to the end of his days. And you know, she was a fabulous actress and could do light comedy very well. And her role as Lady Jane, it's probably the rudest that the Carry Ons get.
Yeah.
She's sort of accosted by almost every male that she meets when they find out that she's traveling alone. And there's that wonderful running gag, which is quite difficult to explain, isn't it?
Yeah. It's an odd one. It's kind of, you know, well, that's a funny way to fill in the blank, whatever the situation might be.
And then it turns out that she's actually having just as good a time as everybody else.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, as the thing progressed, you don't get the impression that she's really being accosted, that she just kind of thinks this is what I do when I'm traveling. And I don't know how that plays with today's audiences, but who knows?
No, you mean, yeah. Some ways in which the film, I think, does play very well, and this is one of the ones which I think ages better than some other ones, is that it sort of fits in with the Zucker, Abraham Zucker school of comedy, with sort of Airplane and Naked Gun. Mm,
yeah.
It's like, you know, I think the style is actually quite similar. I mean, those early scenes that you mentioned, where Jim Dale is accused of cheating at cricket, I think they're such a wonderful parody of the British obsession with class and with cricket and with the importance of these things.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the things that was coming through to me with the film in general is that it seems to definitely have that string of comedy going through it, where it's all about kind of poking fun at the upper class and don't they all look so ridiculous?
Yeah, yeah. And about, you know, Peter Butterworth's character. We haven't really talked much about him, but he was a wonderful reactor. Peter Butterworth got into show business because he was in Stalag Luft 3 during the war. He was a downed airman in Stalag Luft 3, partially as a way of hiding their possible escape activities, their concert parties. And his comedy partner in the concert parties was none other than Talbot Rothwell, the writer of the Carry On films. That's where Peter Butterworth first got the acting bug. But Butterworth would play off other actors and would get laughs almost without trying. In some films, he's paired with Kenneth Williams, for instance. And Williams, I love Kenneth Williams, but you can see the effort that goes into the performance sometimes. And Jim Dale, again, he's doing a lot of work to get the laughs. And he's wonderful at it. But Peter Butterworth gets almost as many laughs just with a raised eyebrow or with a sad jowl. You know, he doesn't have to do much to steal a scene.
Yeah, there's that whole sequence where, again, going back to the more racier moments of this, where they duck into the harem to try and escape, and of course Phil Silvers is all about, oh yeah, let's stay here, all these gorgeous women, and they're not wearing much clothes, and Jim Dale's like, no, we must leave. I have to remember the family name, and Butterworth says, it's West. Well, we should actually start moving towards the break here, but I want to give you a chance for any final thoughts. You know, we've covered a lot of ground, not just on this film, but on the series in general. I mean, there's so much more to discover. I got to admit, I am thoroughly intrigued to check out more of the Carry On films for myself or anybody out there. I guess, first of all, where do you put Follow That Camel in the grand scheme of 31 films? And, you know, for those of us that are novices, I guess, what are the bases that we must hit when it comes to the Carry On films?
Okay. Well, it comes around the midway point of the Carry On films because it's number 14 of 31. I think definitely top 10, possibly top 5. I am a big fan of Follow That Camel, partially because of the presence of Phil Silvers. I mean, you know, as I said, if you're British, Phil Silvers is a comedy god, and it's just so wonderful just to get more Bilko, which in effect is what you get here.
Mm-hmm.
Where else to go? It's a very, as an American audience, it might be an idea to go with the movie spoofs. Carry On Screaming is an excellent spoof of the Hammer films. And, of course, Britain's a small country, a relatively small movie colony, and it was quite easy for them to replicate the Hammer look because Hammers were made on a similar shoestring budget to the Carry Ons, and they were, most of them, photographed by Alan Hume. Alan Hume had only 2 years earlier photographed Kiss of the Vampire. So he knew Hammer. He could do that quite easily. So I think there is enough for an audience to grab onto there who isn't necessarily familiar with the English idiom. I mean, I was watching this week. I was watching Follow That Camel, thinking some of these gags are very British. Are people going to understand? Yeah, it's almost like, you know, let's get a big international star, but what are we going to do? Make the most British comedy we possibly can.
Well, and it really surprised me in some moments where you had Phil Silvers, who, you know, no bones about it, is an American there, and he's delivering some jokes that seem very British. I can't remember the exact way it's phrased, but there was that one joke about, you know, the House of...
Fools or something like that, is it? Oh, yeah, Downing Street.
Yes, yes. And I was like, that just surprised me, you know, for an American character. We don't know that stuff right off the top of our head, clearly, because I just fumbled on it myself.
It's a similar film to Follow That Camel. Head straight to Carry On Up the Khyber. Carry On Up the Khyber is a spoof of films like The Four Feathers and things like that, sort of British adventures in India. It's a spoof of all those sort of the British Army in India adventures.
Okay.
It's one of the key films in the series. The end sequence is regarded as being an absolute classic of British comedy.
Hmm.
So yeah, that, I'd say, actually is probably the next one to go to because it's quite similar to Follow That Camel, if anything, funnier. And you get to see Sid James in the lead role, playing a kind of British Cockney version of the Phil Silvers character in this. So you can see kind of what would have been if Sid had been in this one.
Well, I'm pretty sure that Carry On Up the Khyber is streaming here in the U.S. free on Tubi, which I keep on saying is the best streaming service out there right now, and it's 100% free. So I'll have to check that one out next for sure.
Worth every penny.
All right, well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who the f*** that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, art house gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and like people who feel like my weird way can like get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast and on Twitter at @cinema_recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few bucks a month, you can support the show and earn access to some bonus features in the process, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
New Banana Chalk Sunday. Banana Chalk Sunday.
Real banana fruit ice.
Dairy ice cream.
Covered with chalk and hazelnuts.
What a feast on a stick.
Banana Chalk Sunday with nuts.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie that we've enjoyed, something we want everybody else to check out. It might be a forgotten film. It might be an old classic. It might be something new on streaming or in the theaters. It can be anything. So, Ian, what's your recommendation?
Okay. One of my great loves of films as a film buff has always been 50s monster movies. I've been a big fan of Ed Wood, probably since I was about 15 years old, which is way before the Tim Burton movie. But I'm not going to recommend one of his because everybody knows his films. I'm going to recommend a 1958 British-American horror film, monster movie, called Fiend Without a Face.
Wonderful.
I have a history with Fiend Without a Face because in the early 80s when I was just first trying to learn as much as possible about movies, it was before the days of home video had really come over to Britain. And so the only way I could get to see new, rare, unusual films, I bought a movie projector, of course. You know how everyone's buying record decks again, buying vinyl? Uh-huh. You just watch my words. This time, everyone's going to have a movie projector. You mark my words. Well, I bought a movie projector. And the reason I bought a movie projector is that I bought a couple of films, sight unseen. And these films probably represent the two different aspects of my love of film. One of the films I bought was Top Hat, the Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. Wonderful 30s art deco musical, just absolute perfection. I love that film to this day. I still have my 8mm copies of these films. This isn't even Super 8. This is the old Standard 8 type. Bigger sprocket holes. Anyway, the other film I bought was Fiend Without a Face. And you know what you were saying about earlier about the Carry-Ons are quite different in terms of what they could get away with in certain areas than American films. Well, The Fiend Without a Face is this thing where there's an American airbase near an atomic plant. And as some result of this, it's only a MacGuffin, it doesn't really matter. There are these monsters which are invisible for half of the film, which is a nice money-saving gag.
Yep.
So you get a lot of actors sort of clutching their throat, going, and dropping down dead. Great, saves a lot of money. But when they are revealed, they're incredibly impressive. It's a brain with mandibles. I talk about this to my partner. She's seen the film. She says, oh, they're cute. It's a brain and a spinal cord. And you know how cartoon snakes move with that kind of undulating thing? That's how they move. The spinal cord moves like a cartoon snake. But they're incredibly effective. I mean, yeah, they're cute. Yeah, they're funny how I describe them. In the film, it's really genuinely scary. For a film from 1958, you really think everyone's going to die. Marshall Thompson is the star. Was it Daktari? He was, wasn't it? And what they did was that they hired an animation house to stop motion animate monsters. That is a West German animation house. Now, West German films, as anybody who loves the Edgar Wallace series from West Germany knows, the West Germans could get away with a lot more violence and gore than Britain or America was used to. So they delivered the effect for these films with full-on splatter gore, with these monsters being splattered by sawn-off shotguns, and they just put them in the film. And so this is a really strange outlier. It was a pretty big hit at the time, actually. So that everybody the following year made a thing called First Man into Space because they'd done so well with this one. But I would recommend Fiend Without a Face to anyone. I have my 8mm copy to this day, even though I have upgraded to DVD at some point. And I still have a VHS recording of an off-air screening of it because I just can't bear to get rid of any of my copies of this film, just in case it's the last one. All the other copies die of movie disease or something. But yeah, if you ever get the chance to see it, it's an absolutely unique experience. And it's almost like it's partially a very staid 1950s British film. It's partially an American monster movie. And then partially it looks forward to kind of an Italian zombie movie from the 70s.
Yeah.
It's going to die horribly.
It's a fun one. I remember seeing it years ago. One of the weird areas of horror for me. I find monster brain movies to be really intriguing. As a matter of fact, I think that this would be a great double feature. And I think I prefer the film I'm about to mention more, but do a double feature of Fiend Without a Face from 1958 and from the previous year, 1957, The Brain from Planet Aros, which has a fantastically wacky performance from John Agar in it. So.
Oh, this is all taking me back to when I first started discovering these films with the Golden Turkey Awards book by the Medved brothers.
Yep, I read it too.
Michael Medved turned out to be the worst film writer in the world eventually. However, he really lit a fire under a lot of people, you know, discovering this new world of cinema that I didn't realize existed. That's where I first, like a lot of people, that's where I first heard of Ed Wood. And, you know, I love Ed Wood. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'll see you over on the Ed Wood Facebook groups because I'm on there all the time.
All right. Well, the film that I am going to recommend, I decided to go with low-hanging fruit here for sure. It was a movie that popped into my mind as I was watching Follow That Camel. And I was like, oh, I really enjoy that movie. And it's been so long since I saw it, with Phil Silvers in Follow That Camel, basically playing Sergeant Bilko. I have to mention the 1996 Steve Martin film, Sergeant Bilko, where they tried to do a feature film version of that old TV show, you know, updating it with Steve Martin and Dan Aykroyd and Phil Hartman and such. And I just laugh like an idiot every time I see that movie. Again, I've said how I really enjoy movies where you've got this band of misfits that are coming together to do whatever. And you've certainly got that going on with Bilko here as you know, he's got his barracks full of crazy characters and they're pulling their cons there on the army base. I've always loved the goofy version of Steve Martin. You know, I love looking back to his earlier films when you have stuff like The Jerk and Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid and The Man with Two Brains, stuff like that. And here at the time that Sergeant Bilko comes out, this is where we were starting to see a change in Steve Martin. You know, he was doing films like Parenthood and Father of the Bride and Father of the Bride 2, you know, stuff like that. He was becoming the family man in these movies. And so it was nice to see him do a return to the goofier characters that he started with here in Sergeant Bilko. And I love the supporting cast. Like I said, Dan Aykroyd's in here, basically being a straight man in this, but I think he does a great job with it. Phil Hartman is the nemesis, and he is great in that as well. I also love Glenn Headley in this movie as Bilko's kind of long-suffering fiance. It's just got so many great lines. As a matter of fact, just the other day, before I even knew I was going to recommend this movie today, I used a line from this movie because I was having a rough day at work. The phone would not stop ringing, and I said, "Make the bad man stop," like Steve Martin does in one scene of this movie. So yes, after watching Phil Silvers and Follow That Camel, I must have a rewatch of Sergeant Bilko soon.
Wasn't it interesting that he did that, and he did the Pink Panther as well in that same period? Had this period where he was taking on iconic roles and really kind of making them his own. And I can't think of anybody who would have had the bravery to do that.
I've always enjoyed Steve Martin. I think he's wonderfully versatile. He can do the more serious stuff. You know, he can do those family man comedies. But when he does something that's just really goofy, he's fantastic at that. So, yeah, I'm always there for Steve Martin. All right. Well, Ian, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find your books and all the things you've got going on out there.
Oh, my book, my latest book is called Carrying On, the Films of Peter Rogers and Gerald Thomas, available in all good bookstores and most bad ones, and on Amazon. Please buy my book. I need the money. My previous books, you can, if you want to hear me blather on about British horror films, my magnum opus, the British horror film From the Silence to the Multiplex, is also available. And my book on the careers of Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, called The Worlds of Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, is also available. And I can highly recommend it, but I am a little biased.
No problem there at all. All sound like extremely intriguing subjects. I'm sure you cover them thoroughly, so that's fantastic. Well, thanks again for being on the show, and I will be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, folks, that brings us to the end of this episode of the show. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to read more reviews of Forgotten Films, you'll find them over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget about our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, go watch some old movies. We'll see you again real, real soon.
What an odd way to check my porthole.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.